The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. So on Monday morning at 9:30 a.m, Manchester City celebrated their biggest win of the season, eclipsing their 8-0 demolition of Watford in September. Their two-year ban from the Champions League was overturned and their fine reduced from 30 million to 10 million euros. Lots of questions then. Why was it overturned? Because City had been treated unfairly or because UEFA didn't know their own rules? Is this a victory for football that any side with a tiny bit of billionaire help could break into the elite? Or is this the beginning of the end, a victory for sports washing and the end of effective governance? And where will it all end with the cryogenically frozen head of Richard Keys hosting Doha FC versus Abu Dhabi United on Super Sunday in the Premier League in 2095, while empty stadiums in the UK are even emptier than they are at the moment? Or will it all feel very much like it did last year and the year before that? We'll explain all the boring detail in a hopefully entertaining way, and we'll guide you through the implications for the game, all in today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, good morning.
Hello. I'd just like to say I don't know the answers to any of those questions you asked in the introduction, so I'm just here for the ride and an education.
Barney Ronay, do you know any of the answers to the questions?
No, I don't really know any of the answers to anything. I just have feelings. And I voice them sometimes.
Feelings are an important part of the podcast. So the heavy lifting then, Tariq Panja from the New York Times. Morning, Tariq.
Morning. I think I may know as many of the answers UEFA clearly did when they started this investigation.
Can I start with a glossary of terms? And I know some listeners will be across all of this, but I don't think most football fans follow football for verdicts from the Court of Arbitration for Sport. So I'd like to sort of really strip it down. And if I oversimplify it, if Barry, if you really understand it, then you just stop me, okay, Baz? So, CAS, the Court of Arbitration for Sport, right? That is an international body established in 1984 to settle disputes related to sport through arbitration. They have come to this verdict. Tariq, who are they? Like, who are the people in that room?
There's a list. There's a long list of sports lawyers, arbitration lawyers, and it's about 100, 150 of these people. Often, though, it's only a small group that get picked repeatedly because they seem to know what they're doing. The other interesting thing here is normally the governing bodies win. So UEFA, FIFA, IOC, etc. They tend to be taken to court by the people they've ruled against, City in this case, or a football player, or gear, or whatever. And more likely than not, CAS has upheld the verdict. People say that's largely because this organisation is funded by those sports organisations, so they tend to get the verdicts in their favour, which makes the City case, kind of contrary to that, maybe show it might be more independent than people have thought before.
Okay. Now, the CFCB, that is the Club Financial Control Body, that is part of UEFA, and that has, according to UEFA's website, the important role of overseeing the application of the UEFA club licensing and financial fair play regulations. They imposed the ban in the first place. Tariq, who are they? Who's in that room?
Right. So two chambers or two kind of bodies. One, which is like an investigating force, and the other is a team that makes the judgment once these guys have looked into the various cases. So in that first group, it's led by this guy, Yves Leterme, former Belgian prime minister. I don't know why he's in charge of this, apart from being the former Belgian prime minister. I don't know what his other background is, but it included, at the time, lawyers, economists. Rick Parry was there, former Liverpool chief executive, that upset City, I think, somewhat. And then you've got the adjudicatory chamber. This is sort of the judges that act on the investigation carried out by these people. And that's led by a Portuguese judge, Mr. Cunha. And then it's got eminent senior QCs, got Christian Timmermans from the European Court of Justice and Charles Flint, who, perhaps until yesterday, was seen as a really safe pair of hands, the British QC. I understand he was responsible for much of the City decision.
Two more from the glossary. Manchester City, they are a football team. I think we're all comfortable with that. Owned by Sheikh Mansour, who is the Deputy Prime Minister of the UAE and a member of the Royal Family of Abu Dhabi. Okay, is everyone happy with that, Barry? You happy with that one?
Yep.
And FFP is the final bit of the glossary. Financial fair play, approved by UEFA in 2009, introduced in 2010 to prevent clubs that qualify for its competitions from spending beyond their means. UEFA say the concept, developed and supported by the entire football family, recognises the need for Europe-wide action to restrict some of the worst excesses of the game. The project continues to receive almost universal support amongst football stakeholders, almost being the key word there. Some clubs and fans believe its only aim is to protect those at the top. That is the end of my glossary of terms. Did I miss anything out, or are we good to continue?
Oh, it's pretty thorough, I thought.
So, in February, UEFA issued this two-year ban on Manchester City after ruling they committed serious breaches of FFP between 2012 and 2016. Yesterday, that ban was overturned by CAS, reduced the fine from 30 million to 10 million euros. CAS's panel found that City did fail to cooperate with the investigations by the CFCB and imposed a 10 million euro fine for that. Please refer to the glossary for those acronyms. The CAS award emphasised that most of the alleged breaches reported by the adjudicatory chamber of the CFCB were either not established or time-barred. They will release their full working in a few days. Manchester City, who have denied wrongdoing throughout, said in a statement, "The club welcomes the implications of today's ruling as a validation of the club's position and the body of evidence that it was able to present." UEFA's statement, UEFA notes that the CAS panel found there was insufficient conclusive evidence to uphold all of the CFCB's conclusions in this specific case, and that many of the alleged breaches were time barred due to the 5-year time period foreseen in the UEFA regulations. So is this all down, Barney, to time barring? And in which case it seems madness that this all comes down to UEFA not knowing their own rules.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect when we get the full reasoned judgment, it won't seem quite so simple. But on the face of it, it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, there's clearly been legal argument and legal disagreement about the time frame for these offences. And clearly, UEFA's chamber came to one conclusion and CAS has come to another. So it's not simply a question of getting the dates wrong. But I do know, I mean, as a former lawyer myself, this is like the most embarrassing thing that could have possibly happened to these people. It's so embarrassing. It reminds me of being a junior sort of assistant and going to a case. I had to go to a case in the Privy Council, which is the most terrifying, for me, the most terrifying room. It's full of men so old, whose wigs are so old that they're kind of grey. And I remember Lord Bingham was there, who's the most you can almost feel his brain pulsing through the room. And there are people standing up saying things that you just can't even understand the first word, let alone the 10th word. And what I had done was prepare the bundles. So everyone had a bundle and everyone was going, right, page 7, tab 3. And I'd spent the night before doing this without realising Lord Bingham would be going through this in front of 200 people with me sitting at the back. And at some point, one of the bits had been put in backwards. And Lord Bingham's laser brain instantly identified that this had been put in backwards. And I honestly felt like I was going to die on the spot. Like I was just going to be machine gunned by Lord Bingham. So I'm not this guy's a QC, you know, Flint. It's just an awful thing that it's so embarrassing that something like this, but clearly it's not quite like me in the bundles, and there are legal arguments behind this. And we must assume that the time barred offences actually had some substance to them, and that these are actually the issues that led to a 2-year ban, you know, so stringent. For that to be overturned, we must assume that the things that were time barred were material, because on the face of it, yeah, it's a disaster for UEFA. I mean, they look totally incompetent, in my opinion.
So what I'm keen to know is how much of what was thrown out was the time-barred stuff, because there's other bits as well that they said, well, you haven't got enough evidence, you couldn't prove it enough, even if it wasn't time-barred. So we need to know how much of this was time-barred. And there's a interesting point to this as well. It's not that they did not know. I mean, I had a chat with people yesterday. This rule is kind of there in black and white. It's Article 37 of some document they've got, and it says it there, 5 years or whatever it is, statute of limitations. So what I'm told is they checked with UEFA's in-house lawyers and outside counsel before they even started the investigation. So all of this time, I mean, we've been, is it 2 years? It feels like it's 10 years, to be honest with you. But, you know, we've been dragged through this thing for a number of months. And this was checked at some point early on. And it's their rule. It's not Man City's rule. It's UEFA defending its own rule. So they drew the bloody thing. So they should know when 5 years start, what it's attributable to. But if you read the document, this article, it is quite vague in that it says from the time of the offence or something like this. So I spoke to two different people, one of them being one of the architects of the statute. And this person was saying, well, as far as they were concerned, it was from when we found out about the wrongdoing, which presumably is when they were told about this email in 2018. Somebody else said there was a race against time to get this thing done by a period in May 2019 in order to include all of this. And it appears both of those have fallen short when it came to cash. So, yeah, really interested to see this reasoned document when it comes out in a few days' time.
Tariq, Manchester City have been punished for not cooperating and indeed obstructing the investigation into them. How much of that lack of cooperation and obstruction do you reckon is a factor in this time barring, or is it?
It's a really good point, because if one of the factors of the time barring is the clock starts when the adjudicatory committee makes its judgment. The fact is, you could see from the original UEFA ruling and this CAS one that City dug their heels in and dragged this thing out. There were quite a lot of delays, and there was an appeal, a previous appeal at CAS that was thrown out as well before we even got to this point, and that slowed the process down somewhat as well. So potentially, some people do think, well, hang on a minute, if you're the target of the investigation, and now you're benefiting from a time barring that you might have had a part to play in.
I think that's a really key point that Tariq makes. You know, also the point that Cass normally wins these things. You know, anyone who's ever sat in a courtroom will tell you that the guys who come in with two blokes in wigs, five blokes behind them, seven men and women behind them, because they usually are men and women because they're the solicitors, they tend to win. And the question of their competence, I mean, don't forget the PSG case, which, as I understand it, was unable to be brought back to be re-prosecuted due to similar procedural sort of mishaps and mistakes and misunderstandings. And to be honest, like, while I don't like to go along with conspiracy theories and this is all vindictive and politics, I think the two-year ban was excessive. And there was an element of spite in that. 2 years ban. I mean, what we're talking about here is essentially £40 million and some misdirection and not really telling the truth. That was the accusation. The 2 years was a swinging ban. I don't think it would have been that hard to establish that was excessive.
You see it in the CAS ruling as well. I mean, it was a very short paragraph or three paragraphs they published yesterday, but there is some detail there where, you know, it's kind of a good faith process, I guess. It says here the importance of the cooperation of clubs in the investigation conducted by the CFCB is quite high because of the limited investigative means of these aren't policemen. They just deal with whatever you give them. And it says Man City's disregard for such a principle and its obstruction of the investigations, the panel found, a significant fine should be imposed. And I guess there's no point doing any of this if none of it's in good faith. It's a bit of a mess, isn't it?
I mean, that's a very good point in that obstructing the process seems to be a slightly kind of underwhelming offence here. I mean, if you miss a doping test, whether it's your fault or not, you're deemed to have committed, you know, pretty much the same offence as you know, failing one, if you miss three. Obstructing the process to you or I, probably that I'd feel pretty worried about that if I've been obstructing a police investigation. But apparently that's not such an issue here. I'd like to understand that more fully. Certainly those words make it sound like there should be a greater penalty for this.
So can I just be clear? The ruling does not exonerate City, does it? Or does it?
Well, it depends what you mean by exonerating. The sanction was deemed incorrect. So in that sense, yes. The time-barred offences, which we don't really know anything about, but we're talking about them, have not been examined, so they haven't been cleared of those. They've been fined for obstructing UEFA's processes. So it depends what exonerate. I mean, to be honest, I think a few of you probably agree with me. I'm not that interested in financial fair play. What are we objecting to here exactly? I mean, financial fair play is a fairly dry bureaucratic process designed to prevent clubs racking up unsustainable debts. I don't think it was necessarily brought in to stop people who are good for the money spending money, but that's part of the process. And you also don't want to put off legitimate investors in clubs by the fact they're going to be competing against nations with bottomless pockets. So there's various reasons. But I'm more interested in the fact that the way this cuts across the ownership of City. I mean, you've got clubs being owned by essentially by a country is far more interesting to me than FFP. And the way they were accused of breaking these rules comes from that. If you own a club, you're going to want that club to be sponsored by your country. That's the whole point. You're not going to want Coke to sponsor it. You're going to want your national airline. The whole point is publicity and reach for your country. So that's how they got into this problem in the first place. It's like if Scotland bought a club and suddenly everything was sponsored by the Scottish Tourist Board or shortbread or natural gas or these various nationalised Scottish industries. And suddenly Nicola Sturgeon was the CEO and people started saying, I really like Nicola Sturgeon and she speaks a lot of sense. She should be Prime Minister of Britain or Scotland should actually have independence because look, they're subtly feeding in various messages about what a great country they are. Then I'd sort of have a problem with Scotland owning a club and think maybe that's not what sport or football is for.
There's definitely what Barney has described really well there. But you also have to remember that Man City were bought the year before FFP was announced. That must be gutting because you've got all of this money. You want to spend it and suddenly this rule has appeared. So you're going to be scratching your head and thinking, what are we going to do? And at that point, I don't think there are a bunch of companies looking to pour money into that project. So they did need to raise funds and they did need sponsorship from somewhere. And look, they somehow convinced a load of companies in the Emirates where their owner is based to sponsor them for a huge amount of money. And that has helped them get through this process. It's not something they chose. It was something that perhaps was enforced upon them by the UEFA rules. And here we are today, I guess.
So is FFP good and is FFP dead? And as Barney says, is that not the interesting part of this?
Well, it's not dead. I think there's a lot of hysterical kind of, this is the end of UEFA sort of stuff. I mean, David Conn was quite good on this, and I think he's generally got a fairly sober handle on these things. But, you know, I think people tend to forget that back in May 2005, there was all this talk about Michel Platini deciding to relax this system that he himself had been so keen on, and there was talk of, maybe we've really lessened the debt burden across Europe. And then within days, this kind of enormous scandal appeared, which kind of washed everything away and washed him away. And that didn't really seem to happen. So who knows where we'd be by now if the man who had brought this in had reached, he might have ended up running FIFA. I think it's an interesting system and makes a lot of sense. You do have to stop ludicrous, unsustainable spending sprees. It's the intersection with people who say, well, I'm good for the money, why can't I invest? That's when you get into ideological arguments about what do you want sport to be? And does that utterly distort the market and create other dangers for other people in the same market? And then you have the very legitimate point that how else are you supposed to break into this ancestral cartel? How do you compete with Barcelona and Real Madrid, who just happen to have a stranglehold on an entire nation themselves? It's a very interesting debate.
It's actually done quite a bit of the bit that it was supposed to kind of get right, it's done. I guess the losses were about 1.9 billion cumulatively around the time it came in, a decade ago. And now you know, UEFA published these annual reports, and you know, it's in the black, football across Europe. So in terms of clubs largely going to the wall with unsustainable mountains of debt and losses piling up, that bit of it kind of has worked. And I think Man City fans have a point. I think fans of any team who aspire to try and, you know, rise up the ranks in a world where you buy the best players and you win football matches. And if that's the way the structure is, it is very hard if you're going to be bought by you know, a new investor, be it a country or a businessman or whoever, to kind of make that leap from an also round into this top group. There is a review actually taking place. UEFA is reviewing financial fair play. It's going to look different. I don't know what it will look like. They were waiting for this Man City thing to kind of disappear because there's a massive grey cloud over the whole process. And if they changed anything before, it'd be like, ah, gotcha. Look, you know, you were just doing this to get Man City. So it was a whole, they were waiting. And now we've got COVID, which has paused FFP for a year anyway. So this is a great moment for people to reflect on what they want and how this thing's going to look like in the future anyway. I doubt it will look the same.
Before we get on to big existential questions like the one Barney asked, what do we want sport to be? City do remain under investigation by the Premier League, who don't have a time-barring restriction, as far as I understand. So what can we expect from that? I mean, I can't imagine it's in the Premier League's interests to ban Man City from the Premier League for 2 years. I mean,
I would suspect that will be quietly shelved.
Yeah, I'd go along with Barry. I they're going to suddenly come out all guns blazing. So we don't care what Cass says. I mean, they just want a nice flash game with graphics that go whoosh.
Anyway, that will do for part one. Big existential questions to come in part two. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, Barry, we have an unofficial non-Guardian live online stream. You, me, Jonathan Wilson and Lars Sivertsen on Tuesday the 21st of July. Anyone on earth can buy a ticket. Currently, quite a few billion haven't bought tickets.
what are you waiting for, people?
So look, wherever you are in the world, you can come. We're tweeting out all the details. And if the time doesn't suit you, you know, we have quite a large Australian audience, you can watch it on catch up. But Barry, it will be the greatest 2 hours of anyone's life, won't it?
I would be very surprised if anyone who tunes in isn't having the time of their lives for 2 hours.
Now, Barney, you in part one said, what do we want sport to be? What is the point of sport? We rarely step back and ask ourselves why we love sport and why we care about it and what we want it to be. And I'm not sure if I know the answer.
No, I mean, everyone has a different view of that, don't they? I mean, I'm probably stuck in a certain time and a certain set of politics, and you know, probably that's not what most people think. But I suppose my ideal of sport, or say a European football competition, is something where there's a kind of mobility where if you build a team, you can win it. Which I guess was probably last the case in the 80s or the 70s, and where it wasn't simply governed by finance. And I mean, there are whole arms even of the football journalism industry which talk about things that, frankly, I've absolutely no interest in, to do with the constant sort of player carousel and balancing. It's become something that I find fairly tedious. I'd like to see an accessibility to that group, which is, I guess, exactly what Man City fans are saying. But they're saying the way to access that group is to spend billions and billions of pounds on players. But for me, the idea of sport is something that is accessible, and that if you're Ajax and you happen to build a brilliant team, it doesn't immediately get dismantled because you don't have the money to keep those players. And that it's sort of broadly open to everyone.
Is there a counter-argument that someone somewhere will say, look, it's always been like this, just not quite as extreme? And should we just enjoy the football that we currently have at any given time?
Yeah, it's absolutely always been like that, but not to such a degree. There are teams in the Championship now who cannot dream of winning the Premier League. It's not an issue. It could never happen. And that is a shame. And I suppose the way around that is to say, well, you should just open it up to anyone who wants to buy a club and hurl money at them, and then maybe they will. But that's not the way I would like it to work. And obviously I'm talking about something that just can't happen here. But possibly there may be ways of engineering that, like salary caps or something even more vicious than FFP.
Sure. I mean, so what are the... I think most people would like there to be more competition in all tournaments. And I think most people would like there to be, you know, that chance to dream, right? You know, Cambridge almost got into the Premier League in 1992. And, you know, that is the dream that now is just not a realistic prospect. And I'd love that dream to still be possible.
Well, it is still possible. Yeah. I mean, one of the ways around it is extreme competence. Liverpool is a brilliantly run club and are now the champions of the world. And 10 years ago, they weren't anywhere near that. And they've done that not by spending money, but by being run by the smartest people in the room and having some brilliant sort of process and having a brilliant manager. And that's a good model that works. But unfortunately, that's extremely rare as well. I mean, I sound like Jeremy Corbyn saying we should, you know, everyone should work in a jam factory and we should renationalize everything. Obviously, you know, it's probably a ludicrous suggestion, but I would back any measure which returns some degree of competitiveness across the league. I mean, I don't see what's wrong with a salary cap if it was enforceable. I think that'd be a great idea. I even started thinking maybe Sepp Blatter's laughable idea, which everybody laughed at the time, about having a quota of players from your home nation in your team, which was one of the alternatives to FFP that they talked about. But that sort of seemed ridiculous because it's like protectionist working practice and just sounds weird. But maybe that's actually quite a good idea. Imagine if you had to have a certain number of homegrown players in your team, how that would level the playing field. You'd be forced to coach and develop. Of course, people would then end up buying 12-year-olds for £90 million from their neighbours and it would all go wrong. But it's not the worst idea if it makes you work on your team.
One of the things that they're looking at are these, whether it will happen or not, but why not cap the number of transfers and professional football players you can have in each team? Like, you know, Juventus and Chelsea seem to have 200 players on their book. These are 200 people who are either not playing or sent really far away and not at a competitor. By doing that, you raise the level, I guess, of the median team, because all those players come back into the pot rather than us sat, you know, in the Juventus C team or wherever they get sent, and you kind of build it. The other is this luxury tax. So you breach FFP if you want, and you spend this money, but you give the equivalent amount of money into your rival teams to spend as well. So you're kind of inflating the whole market. I don't see merit in that. And the other interesting thing here is perhaps the way the European competition works, for example, because I guess, you know, we're all of a certain age, and I'm not exactly sure how someone who's 20 watches and appreciates football now, but the period Barney was talking about, you have these two-leg knockouts from the beginning, and you're going to have shocks, and you're going to have people getting, a glorious run, a golden run through a tournament, and you'll have a team lifting a cup. But the way the Champions League works, the group phase and everything else, you kind of neutralise that shock effect. And by the time you get to the knockout, you have this kind of same old teams in that phase. And someone said, well, what about a European breakaway? The thing is, we pretty much already have one. I would argue that when you look at the round of 32, basically the knockouts of the Champions League onwards, and who's in the last four and the quarters, pretty much the same team. So it might as well be a breakaway anyway. And that sort of surprise factor has disappeared. I remember Panathinaikos being in a semi-final, the Steaua Bucharest final against Barcelona. I mean, we don't even hear about those teams. And as a kid, for me, I learned a lot of my geography through that, to be honest with you, because you kind of find these places interesting and you try and look them up. So there was... It was just football was different there, not better, not worse. Again, I can say it was better for me,
yeah,
because I was a child then and I enjoyed it. Maybe there's 20-year-olds who love these super clubs and that's all they want to watch and it's brilliant.
It's interesting though, having said that and having criticised the same old club sort of thing, I also love the Champions League later rounds. You know, they're brilliant. The standard of football is incredibly high. They're really thrilling. They're often very tight games. And you raise the FA Cup. I mean,
yeah,
I'd rather watch the late stages of the Champions League than the FA Cup. You know, having criticised it, it's an incredible product. And I understand why someone who's 19 might say, what are you talking about, Grander? This is brilliant. Look at these brilliant players we've gathered together all on the same pitch. It's like a World Cup every year. And it is it's the best football. The late stages, maybe not the group stages, are really good.
And actually, if you think about those two second legs last season, the semi-finals, like, you won't get two better days of football, will you?
Well, the latter stages of the Champions League last season were just unbelievably good. And the group stages are generally a bit of a grind. There are very few. You get the odd surprise result, but you don't get, very rarely do you get surprise qualifiers for the knockouts. You know, there's Atalanta have raised a few eyebrows and got people talking this season, and there's, you know, often an Atalanta to do that. But yeah, I do really love the latter stages of the Champions League. The group stages, no, they're I find them very tedious.
Well, I just would add also that this, even though everybody's got opinions on City and the case and all that kind of stuff, it's given us the most amazing story as well. I mean, I was at City when they were Madrid game in Madrid just before lockdown, and that was an incredible game of football. You know, one of the best things I've seen all season. Imagine how amazing it's going to be from here, their little run in Europe. It gives us this incredible narrative. You'll be absolutely gripped to it. I'm convinced they're going to win the Champions League now because they have a brilliant team. They're all fit, and they're just going to be driven by this massive sense of grievance as well. And as we know, grievance makes the world go round, especially in football. So it has given us an incredible drama.
Can I ask about UEFA? I've read various pieces saying, you know, is this the end of UEFA? Can UEFA survive this? Can football clubs be governed at all? Will it be outlaws like the Wild West? Tarek, is that sort of hyperbole?
I guess, yeah, because they're there and they're going to be there. The interest for me, what I find interesting is what UEFA and FIFA are. No other kind of industry has this, where you have a kind of policeman governing body role, but you're also a competitor. So UEFA is putting on tournaments. Champions League, we've talked about. UEFA is fighting for sponsorship money. You see that, the boards around the stadiums. UEFA is also fighting for TV rights, competing with the leagues and the clubs for this money that the leagues and the clubs are trying to get. Meanwhile, it is their policemen that can ban them and do all these other things to them and tell them, you know, for me, that's always been a bad fit because the world changed. Well, this was an amateur, you know, all these FIFA and UEFA were sports organisations before sport got commercialised. And we've kind of just allowed them to roll on as they were. Once money gets involved, it does become really complicated. You've got UEFA and FIFA fighting over who runs football, club football. You've got FIFA trying to take these clubs into their orbit now with Gianni Infantino and his new competitions. You've got UEFA fighting back. And then you've got the clubs who have been talking about breakaways and all sorts, unless they don't get their way. To me, it seems like if you were to draw this out again on a blank sheet of paper and what football looks like and how it's run, it probably wouldn't be run like this with all these commingling interests and things done for the kind of wrong reason. So perhaps that's going to be a conversation that takes place. And people say the only way that the governance of football ever changes or will change is when people get led away in handcuffs. And we saw that in 2015 in May with FIFA. But then I would argue the kind of chairs have changed because you just put new people in them. But structurally, there hasn't been much change even after that. So if that couldn't really bring down or change football fundamentally, like the FBI popping in, I don't think we're about to see the end of UEFA or FIFA or anything like that in the coming years.
That'll do for part two. We've got a few more questions about the City verdict in part three and any other business to come to. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Before we get on to the short-term implications for Manchester City, Javier Tebas, the La Liga president, said CAS isn't the right place for these verdicts. Tarek, is he right? And why is he so bothered about all of this?
Well, he's been bothered about this since the beginning because, well, he's Javier Tebas as well, and he's always angry about something. And this one he alighted on because he talked about Petro spending clubs, destroying football as he knows it. But, of course, in La Liga, there is the issue that Barcelona and Real Madrid cannot be owned by anyone as well. So these are threats to perhaps the two biggest teams in his league that can never have a structure like that anyway. So there is a reason. And I guess Javier Tebas just doesn't like this type of thing like other people, and he's always very outspoken. And in terms of CAS, that's what the sports court is, and there's you know, it's another program to kind of get really into the ins and outs of whether CAS is fit for purpose and what could replace it. Because at the reason we have CAS as well is sport on a global level will cover, you know, God knows how many different jurisdictions, and you could take your case to courts all over the world and get different verdicts, and that will perhaps stymie a European body or a football structure like this. So if you have a one-stop shop that everyone, in a sense, buys into, that would make some sense. However, people are saying the verdicts that come out favour the governing bodies, obviously not in this case, more than the little man or the club, etc.
A lot of the information from this case came from football leaks. Has that been a force for good?
Well, it's certainly given us some brilliant stories. I think so. I think it's really good that these things were... It's obviously not good if you're Manchester City and you've suffered what now you will now say is an injustice. You've been accused. But that's to do with a messy prosecution by UEFA. I think the more stuff that is held up to the light, the better. And it's just a bit sad that we have to rely on this kind of Portuguese hipster hacker guy, who is obviously a fascinating figure, to actually get a view into the way this massively unregulated industry, which is run on our money, you know, it's your the money you put into football, which goes into these various places, how it's dispersed. I think the more transparency, the better, and more power to them. I wish they'd come back with some more stuff.
Manchester City can be very excited now about, you know, the rest of this season and the Champions League and next season and what Pep might do to the club, Barney, because they've got, as you say, on their day, they play just the most scintillating football.
Yeah, I mean, that's the brilliant thing about this team, and that you can have whatever reservations you want about its governance or whatever, but they play this beautiful kind of football. And they seem to represent something really noble in the way they play, the teamwork and the amount of sheer sort of work that goes into it, the way players are coached and improved. I mean, for all the talk about spending, City is not really a Hollywood star vehicle. They don't buy ready-made number one player in the world. They buy very good players and make them even better in their team. It's actually a good model in sporting terms. For all the qualms you may have about the spending or the genesis of the money, you know, there's something very, very good there that you can't fail to love. I think that players are fit. They really missed Laporte. And there was even something beautiful in the fact they failed to buy a central defender and they obviously needed one. It's like, no, we don't do that. We just keep attacking. And he's back and he's very important for every part of the pitch for them. And everybody's fit apart from Aguero. I really think that they might well go to that little mini Euros and win it. And ideally play PSG in the final, which would be a fantastically weird occasion. I look forward to seeing the UEFA delegation in the stands.
And what do we think they need if they need, you know, to catch up with Liverpool next season?
They need another centre-back, same as last summer, I think.
How many of their players are sort of approaching, you know, being moved on? Yeah.
Well, David Silva isn't going to be there next season, is he? He'll be a big loss, I'd imagine. But, you know, they have ready-made replacements. But I don't think they need much. My main worry for them, and it's only a minor worry, is that some of the players might be kind of sick of Pep Guardiola. Just the over-familiarity of him having been there for such a long time. I'm not saying he's not good at his job. He obviously is. But just you get sick of listening to the same people all the time, as I'm sure you know, Max. I mean, I'm just walking towards a giant manhole there. I could see as that sentence went on.
Barney.
But I think the break might have really helped in that sense. As we know, Pep sort of burns himself out. He's so intense, you know, he doesn't eat anything during the day. He's like churning on adrenaline on match day. And he's had a break. You know, there was a break. I'm sure there were lots of work still, but I think they look really fresh now. I think he looks fresh, and it's going to give him a massive impetus for that next season. I think they do need some players. I think they need a left back. They've bought a lot of left backs, but
left back, yeah,
no, that's not really worked. And I think Fernandinho is such a good player for them, but he's now 46 years old and been playing in defence. And I know Rodri is supposedly the replacement. They might want a better one of those. There's even a chance Aguero might be the wrong, you know, a real gun centre forward might be a good one as well. But I mean, now they can spend whatever they want. No, you know.
Well, I was going to say, can they? Can they now just spend, you know, buy Harry Kane and Chilwell and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, could we see them doing a real up yours and just spending £1 billion in the summer?
They should do what PSG did and buy Neymar and Mbappe in the same season from PSG. I think that would be two statement signings. We can draw a line under all this.
But there is an interesting thing that football wouldn't mind a bit of overspending right now. There are quite a lot of people who are feeling the lost hundreds of millions from broadcast deals. And if anybody wants to inflate the market, hi, Saudis, that's probably okay by quite a few people who might be more concerned about it.
That's a really good point, actually. The market is seen by anyone to be the flattest ever. So if anyone can inject a bit of cash into it to get players moving, Man City suddenly might be seen as a sort of saviour in some way.
Obviously a bad day for Manchester United, really, wasn't it? Because first of all, they found out that fifth place wasn't going to be enough. And then they let in a 96th minute equaliser to Southampton in the sixth minute of 5 minutes of injury time. Southampton are well organised.
Well, I would disagree there. Obviously, Manchester United will be interested in justice being done and the correct verdict being reached. So they will have been celebrating the decision from Switzerland because it means that a correct decision has been reached and this is not a club issue. But I think they're doing so well. They'll hope to finish in the top four, won't they? And probably a worse decision for Leicester, who seem to be really struggling now and haven't managed to get going again and are going to be out-muscled by these more powerful squads.
There was a bit of VAR. I know you like talking about it, Barney. We'd all got almost a whole hour without mentioning it. Romeo, he should have been sent off, but he wasn't. Man United got lucky with VAR last week and they didn't. So it all evens out of the season. We should have more VAR. Greg says, have the Sky commentators given up apologising about swearing now? After last night's match with no crowd noise, we were treated to Che Adams shouting, parental advisory, fuck off, as the camera focused on him after a misplaced pass. Not a mention from anyone. Beautiful, says Greg. We should congratulate Wickham on beating Oxford to get into the championships. Great achievement for them. And Gareth Ainsworth in his red snakeskin boots and Adebayo Akinfenwa just being an incredibly fun bloke after the game. And there was a great stat. I don't know if you saw it. They compared Oxford United and Wickham before the game in terms of their tactics. And they had a list of things which are essentially how much you pass the ball. And it was average possession, Oxford United first, Wickham 23rd. Passes, Oxford first, Wickham 23rd. Short passes, Oxford first, Wickham 23rd. 10 plus passing sequences, Oxford first, Wickham 23rd. Width per passing sequence, which is not something I'd seen before, Oxford first, Wickham 23rd. So, I mean, I'd like to know who was 24th, who literally all they do is punt it upfield in League One. But it was a victory for proper old school football as we know it. Well done to Wickham Wanderers.
Also, can I say that back in Fenway, he lives down the road from me and he's quite a sort of well-known local figure. And he is known as one of the nicest men on earth. Like his reputation sort of stretches around him. I see him in Sainsbury sometimes, actually, and he always seems to have people around him are saying hello to him or whatever, and he genuinely has some really great quality about him. And I can see that probably one of the reasons he's at the club is because of that sort of personality. And when he complained the other week about being racially abused. I felt very sad about that because I know what a sort of nice fellow is and that he wouldn't say that. You know, that came from a sort of real place. You know, he really felt that. And it also just made me think about how sort of split we are as a nation in a way. And that to imagine somebody yelling that at Akin Fenwa around where I live, to stand in the middle of Catford High Street and yell that at him and then afterwards say that's okay, just seems utterly insane. And yet you've got people on Twitter saying, oh, what's the problem? It's not. Obviously it's an insult. And he quite rightly and bravely pointed that out. And people really need to start listening to people who understand this stuff, particularly, you know, Akin Fenwa, who I adore.
I'm with you. You know, I've interviewed and met him a few times, and his joy and happiness and just general goodness is completely infectious.
Well, he is a gent, all right. I did a TV thing years ago, and he was on, and Clinton Morrison was also there. It was just such good fun, because just two incredibly excitable, optimistic guys. And Akin Fenwa sort of had an entourage with him, but it's quite a fascinating couple of hours just to be in their company.
While you mentioned Clinton Morrison, if you haven't, you should see the thing he did on Sky when he was a very young player, shopping for a bed with his mum on Sky Sports News, which just seemed like a very strange idea that passed all editorial. Yeah, it's a great idea, and he was up for it. But there is one more question, Barry. Billy said, would Barry rather be able to make the perfect pudding, any chosen pudding, perfect every time, or be able to swim? I mean, I presume you can swim, but maybe swim to Olympic level.
I can swim, but not particularly well. I would prefer to be able to swim well than make the perfect pudding every time.
What's your best pudding, Barry?
I don't really make pudding. I don't have that much of a sweet tooth. I bake excellent brown bread.
I make a brilliant crumble.
Talk us through it, Barney.
Well, you just need a lot of fruit to stew, then go with an oat, brown sugar, and butter crumble, and don't stint on the fruit filling, which is the best bit. And you can eat it for breakfast.
Perfect. Well, we sold everything. Thanks so much. Thanks for your time, Tarek.
Yeah, cheers, guys.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Barney.
Cheers, bye.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.